Good morning and welcome to this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a look at our world, both in and around the city of Brighton Hove, and now even further afield, thanks to our new and more powerful FM transmitter, all for both our older listeners and those not so old. In this programme we'll be hearing once again from Paul Bromley about the reopening of the Bluebell Railway. There will be news on the Dunkirk Little Ship, which is the steam tug challenge that was restored in the Shoreham Harbour Canal in Hove and which now has a much brighter future thanks to her new owner. Jax Atkins will be here to tell us what is, or rather what is not, happening to the Madeira Drive arches. And we welcome back Chris Seymour, who will be returning to the programme with two interviews, the first of which is all about the collection of scarecrows that have appeared on the streets of Rottingdean recently. However, we get the show underway with Chris Seymour's interview with Rottingdean author David English, whose new 600-page, two-volume book is all about Elvis the King Presley, whose death 43 years ago, on August the 16th, truly shocked the music world. And even if rock and roll isn't to your taste, his songs continue to attract a huge worldwide following. And Chris first asked David to explain what this mammoth book project is all about.
It's a two-book collection with eight CDs, and it's basically about the anniversary of the movie Elvis, That's the Way It Is, which was originally released in 1970.
And this is a big volume. How long did it take you to put it together?
I would say about a year. We talked about it previously, but in anger it took a year, and then that is 24/7. It's every hour of every day. putting it together.
So tell us what's in the set then.
So what you've got is the compact discs are eight compact discs, which comprise of all the rehearsals that Elvis Presley did prior to the movie. And so they weren't really intended for general release, and so this has been released on a collector's label where perhaps the language isn't quite as clean as it could be, because Elvis was just recording for himself and his band members, and so the recordings are not necessarily the perfect quality, but there are a lot of officially unreleased recordings, which is pretty good considering it's 50 years since it was done.
I should imagine they're more interesting than the actual live event sometimes.
Yeah, they are. What it does is it gives a picture as to how he first started to put the songs together into an order, which songs would work together, medleys and things like that. And then as the process goes on, you can see that the very last rehearsal, which was done the afternoon before the first live performance, is very close to the actual live performance.
They're the CDs. Tell us about the two books.
So the two books are split into two. So first one relates to the CDs in the sense of it's all about the rehearsals. And it documents how the movie was put together originally by MGM, and it has MGM correspondence and things like that. And it just goes through with loads and loads of photographs that have never been seen before, painstakingly restored. And so it ends at the very last rehearsal. And then the second book starts on there's five live shows that Elvis Presley did that were filmed by MGM for this documentary, and so these concerts are in the book, plus lots and lots of other things, and there are details in there that I've been able to find that have not been found previously.
And some of the as you mentioned, some of the photos haven't been seen before. How did you manage to get hold of them?
We were approached by a film collector, a photographic collector in the United States, who had the collection for sale. At which point we couldn't refuse, because there were some great shots in there. They were split into two, so black and white negatives and proof sheets and colour. The colour ones on close examination were disappointing, and they were a lot of them out of focus and not very clear. So we dropped those, most of those from the collection, but we managed to get some from the Elvis Presley estate to make up for those. And the black and white ones look superb.
And what's your favourite photo?
Probably the one that's on the back of the live concerts book.
Why?
I think it just gives a really good image. It's not been seen in that clarity before, and I think it's Elvis that is best, really, his prime.
Is it a traditional suit he's wearing,
yes,
on stage?
Yes, he's wearing what would be called a white jumpsuit that had some chains across the front there, and it does look very typical Elvis Presley.
Now then, David, where does your interest in Elvis come from?
Bizarrely, when he passed away, which was just this last Sunday, August the 16th, so that was 1977, that's strangely where my interest started. They then showed a lot of movies of his on BBC during the next Christmas season, and it sort of started to grow from there.
Have you done anything on Elvis before?
Yes, this is my 9th book on Elvis. So, there's been quite a few before, yeah.
Did you have to get permission from Elvis's family to do any of these books?
You don't have to get permission, but these books are released by the official Sony Records. So they are authorised by the official label, so everything is cleared. But in addition, the books have been sanctioned by the Elvis Presley estate, which are Elvis's family. And as a sort of byproduct, a couple of books ago, I was able to present one of the books to Priscilla Presley, where she wrote a nice little note inside. And earlier than that, I met Elvis's daughter and gifted her two of the books, and she was really pleased with those.
And of course, Graceland is where all the fans go. Are you any different?
No, I've been there at this time of year on 4 occasions now. The last one was 2017. Yeah, so I have been there quite a few times.
So let's ask about your co-compiler, Paul Grunlund.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he is a person that is Norwegian, and he is my publisher. And he met Elvis on, I think, about 5 separate occasions and presented him with various gold awards from Norway. Got photographs with Elvis and autographs and things like that. And he has an amazing photographic collection which we're able to dip in and use for our books.
Anybody else involved in the compilation of this set?
There was a lady at the time who I found some reviews that she made, called Rose Knox Peebles, who was a young English girl, I'm guessing about the age, early 20s, who made some really detailed reviews, which really did help me. In she went down to details about the song lists, what Elvis was wearing and what he did, which is, for researchers, is invaluable in terms of, you know, being able to pinpoint the date. And I was just intrigued because she seemed to be from England in the UK, and she was over, obviously, in Las Vegas. And my research hasn't been completed up to date, but I know that she does have a residence in Hove, which is quite weird considering that, you know, it's only a few miles away from me. So I'm hoping that I can get in touch with her once the COVID situation settles down and maybe show her the book.
So, David, tell us, it's quite a large compilation. How much does it cost, and where can you get it from?
Yeah, I mean, the bad news is it's very expensive, just because it's such a limited release. It's not released by the main Sony label. So prices are £180 to about £200, and in the UK you can get them online from a place called Now Dig This, and there's another place called Essential Elvis, which is based in Worthing. And there's another, third place is called Elvis Shop, which is the Elvis Shop, which is in London. And because the success of the book package, it actually sold out prior to going on sale. So we are now in the realms of doing a reprint to fulfil all existing orders.
Very good. And anything else on the horizon for Elvis from you?
There is, but I can't talk about that.
Chris Seymour was talking to the Rotting Dean author, who just happens to be my son, of a very new and very expensive book on the King himself, of course, Elvis Presley. In the last programme, we were hearing from Paul Bromley about the plans to reopen the Bluebell Railway. Well, that happened on Friday the 7th of August, and what a success it was. And to find out just how much of a success, we're joined again by Paul. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Chris.
And just that, you had lots of coverage, television, newspapers, printed magazines. So has it put bums on the seat?
I mean, the first and the most important thing was that we actually reopened. There was a lot of hard work by the staff who'd returned to work in mid-July and all the volunteers coming back to the railway after 4 or 5 months of closure to get everything ready for that reopening day. And it was hugely significant that the wheel started turning once again, that steam returned to Sussex, that we were able to resume our business operations. And the fact that it was on our 60th birthday as well meant it was a double celebration. And the joy, the excitement, the look on everyone's faces as that first train left was a sort of wonder to behold. Perhaps during the worst days of the lockdown and the dark days when we did wonder whether there would be a business to come back to, all that negativity had gone as we were able to celebrate the reopening of the railway once again.
Well, I was very pleased to be able to join the party with my eldest granddaughter and great-granddaughter, whose first trip on the train it was, and she absolutely loved it. And I think that's probably the message from everybody that was there.
Yes, I think it was important that we continue to do what we do best, which is to provide families, young and old, and in your case, very young, the opportunity to experience a steam train ride and a wonderful day out through the lovely Sussex countryside. The fact that the sun was shining, in fact, it was a swelteringly hot day, made it even more pleasant, I think, in one sense, that it was just a wonderful occasion and a wonderful opportunity for us to resume running services again on the Bluebell Railway and to provide the safe and enjoyable day out for thousands of people that we have done for the last 60 years, because that's the main reason why all of us, particularly those of us who are volunteers, give up our time and money to provide people with that wonderful experience. So while the railway was shut, we weren't able to do that. And so the reopening and the delight that all our customers and visitors had on that reopening day was something that we will treasure as much as I think all the passengers who came to see the services running again.
So what happens now, Paul? Does the service start as normal, or is it still you have to book in advance and with limited numbers of services?
We always described it as a phased reopening. We were sort of very clear that we weren't going to start running trains in exactly the same way after lockdown as we had been before lockdown. So all services still have to be pre-booked and they have to be booked online. And of course, that's the first time in the railway's 60 years of operation that people haven't been able to just turn up on the day and buy a ticket from a booking office. So it has meant some changes. Also, because we still don't know the level of consumer demand, we're running services mainly at weekends with some weekday services as well. And we will increase that and get back to a normal running timetable as soon as we possibly can. But we are now relying on people feeling confident enough to come back to the Bluebell Railway. And we've put in place all the necessary measures to ensure that we are COVID secure, as you probably saw when you arrived and departed. And so the message that we're trying to get out is that we're back in business, but there will be some changes necessary in order to ensure that we can provide that safe and enjoyable day out for people once again.
Now, it's one thing reopening, but can you maintain the reduced number of passengers and still be a profitable organisation?
That's the key question. And at the moment, Things are starting to recover. We are delighted that people are continuing to book and to come onto our services, whether it's the normal timetable trains or our special rebranded dining services. But because we are having to use compartments and because we have reduced capacity in some areas, it does mean that every time we run a train, there is a cost involved, and it does rely on sufficient passengers coming, buying their tickets to be able to provide us with enough money to continue to run those services. And as you say, then make some money that we can use to build up our business once again and continue to restore and repair all the various locomotives and carriages that we have. I noticed that some other tourist attractions and some other heritage railways have just written off 2020, and so they aren't going to open until next spring. We took the decision that it was important to get back to resuming our business as soon as we possibly could, and therefore we are now relying on people coming through what is left of the summer and the autumn into the winter to allow us to build our business up once again. But we're not really looking until 2021 or possibly 2022 before we'll get back to some sort of normal way of operating.
Now, you mentioned there the winter. Now, one of the attractions of heritage railways is a visit with the old man with the red coat and the white beard, namely Santa. Will you be running Santa trains?
Santa has been visiting the Bluebell Railway for the best part of the last 60 years, and we always send him an invitation about this time of year to see if he can spare the time to come and visit us and all the families in Sussex. We are currently reviewing all our operations, but we will be offering some sort of Santa experience. We may have to make some changes to what we do as a result of the necessary measures we have to put in place, and I'm sure all the children and all their parents will understand and appreciate that. So yes, there will be some sort of Santa experience at the Bluebell Railway this December. The full details are still being worked on.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us once again, and more power to your elbow for the rest of the season, such as it is. And I look forward to hearing from you again in the future. But in the meantime, how do people get to book? Where do they go to get more information?
All the bookings are done through our online system. If people go to bluebell-railway.com, they will find all the links there to our ticketing service, and they're able to then to choose which particular service they wish to travel on and all the extras as well that are available, including our food and catering offerings that are available. Or they can just follow the Bluebell Railway on social media, on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, and we provide regular updates about the service changes that we're making as we continue to review our operations. But for the moment, we're just delighted that the wheels have started turning once again, although we're still quite a way off from being full steam ahead.
We were hearing from Paul Bromley, Communications Director of the Bluebell Railway.
On 97.2 FM and online at radioreverb.com, this is Radio Reverb, and you're listening to At Home This Morning, a programme for older listeners.
Now, people with a long memory may recall an item in the programme about the Steam Tug Challenge. Challenge was a Dunkirk little ship, or rather I should say, is a Dunkirk little ship, and she's got a new owner, Chris Bannister. Chris, welcome to At Home This Morning, and tell us why you wanted to buy a steam tug.
Well, I've been looking at purchasing Servia in Ramsgate for a while, and I heard that Challenge needed a new home. I have a great interest in steam and boats, and I've always wanted a steamboat. So obviously I then done a bit of research. I found Servia needed a home, and I was looking into it, and then I got contacted about Challenge requiring a new home, and then I've got in touch with the trust, and here I am now owning the thing.
And we're talking in Southampton, which has been a home for the last 4 or 5 years, and sadly she's deteriorated a bit.
Yes, she has. So me and my team are coming along now, and we're doing the best we can do here. Unfortunately, about a month ago, we had to take the boat out of the water because she started to take on water. But I've now sorted this out, thankfully, for myself. I own my own engineering company with, and I employ coded welders, so we were able to tackle this ourselves in-house. And we've now achieved that. She's now floating again. It has delayed other works that are going on, but we're now back here in the water and getting ready for the steam test, which is happening in a few weeks' time.
Now, she was restored thanks to the Heritage Lottery Fund, and that involved putting a new boiler in. So is all of that equipment that was purchased and installed at that time still working?
Yes, all the boiler and plant and all that lot is absolutely fine. There's no issues with that at all. Obviously, with the steelwork that's below the waterline, it's always going to be corroded. So obviously, it was only a matter of time before further works needed to be carried out. Thankfully, while it was out of the water, I did have a company come in and do an ultrasonic test upon the whole hull. They spent a couple of days on it going over it. So I now know the state of the hull, and thankfully, she's good to go now.
And why would somebody want to buy a steam tug? You mentioned earlier that you like boats and you like steam, but why, as she is now, a rusty old hulk?
I like giving myself projects and many things to do, so I like to be able to look at something in a sorry state and bring it round and bring it back to life and then let the public come aboard and appreciate it for what it is, where it's been and what it's actually done in its life. And if I wasn't in the position that I'm in now, it could have been cut up for scrap. So it's just thankful that I am in a position to do it. Yes, it does take up a lot of my time, and it's now ruling my life. But I was aware that I was committing to that when I took it on. And, I'm just thankful that I'm in a position that I'm in to be able to take it over and manage it.
How do you go about buying something like this? I mean, where do you start, apart from with a pocket with quite a lot of money in it, presumably?
Well, it's not as bad the buying bit as you might think. It's the upkeep that's the expensive bit. But like I said, literally I was contacted because they knew that the boat needed a new home because it was meant to go to London. And unfortunately, that fell through. So then I was contacted because people were aware that I was trying to save Servia. And then after being contacted, I then came down, had a look at the boat and tended to take over the ownership of the boat. And here I am now.
Where will she go once you've sorted out the problems at the moment?
In an ideal world, it will be either Ipswich or Great Yarmouth. Either way, it will be on the East Coast. Final destination is yet to be confirmed.
And what will you do with her? I mean, it's not something you can take out of somewhere like Brighton Marina or anywhere and just go for a steam round and come back in again, is it?
No, unfortunately, because of what it is, it takes 7 hours at least just to get steam up. So it's not like I can just pop up the river quickly. But the plan is, obviously, I appreciate the fact that it's quite a valuable asset to our history. And I want people to be aware of the history that it's got associated with it. And I want people to have the pleasure of being able to come aboard, have a look around it, and maybe even take people out on it, if that's an option later on down the line.
She is, of course, as I mentioned, a Dunkirk little ship. So you're far too young to remember anything about 1940 and the Dunkirk evacuation. What does it mean to you?
Well, obviously, history plays a huge part of my life because I also maintain a traction engine which was involved in World War One. So obviously I can appreciate the history and the amount of people's lives that have been affected, especially with something like this, because obviously it brought so many people back from Dunkirk over back to the UK land. And obviously without a vessel like this, many people would have been lost. So it's a huge asset.
And do you think it's a shame that without somebody like you stepping in, a ship like this could have been lost?
Oh, completely. If I hadn't, then it had two options. It was either going to go to Istanbul or go to the scrapyard. And like I said, yes, it's a big commitment to own it and take over the responsibility of it. But if I hadn't come along, those were the two options that it was left with.
As I said, the restoration with the Heritage Lottery money was carried out in Southwick Canal in Hove. Will she ever come into Shoreham Harbour again?
I would like to think so, but hopefully not for extensive work, but just visiting purposes, I'd like to say so.
So your tour around the British Isles, will that be for members of the public, or will it just be for your own enjoyment, or both?
It will be for both, really. Obviously, it would be an epic achievement to be able to steam her all the way around the UK, and then ideally, and then I would love to be able to sell spaces. So say, for example, I was going from Ipswich to Great Yarmouth. I'd like to say, right, I've got 10 spaces available. This is how much it is. If you want to come, welcome aboard.
And do you need special licenses and things like that?
It depends how I do it. If I done it as a business, then yes, I would. But if I say that I need a minimum donation, then I can do it moving forward as I am currently.
And we've talked about money and deep pockets, but how will you raise funds?
I do currently have a GoFundMe page at the moment, so if anyone wants to donate, then just look up the Steam Tug Challenge. Also, there is a link to this on the Facebook page, also under the Steam Tug Challenge. I'm welcoming anybody on board if they want to come and have a look around. It's currently in Southampton. That's not an issue. You are still welcome on board here for a minimum donation. And then, obviously, once it's out and about, then I want to let people come aboard and charge people to come aboard and appreciate it.
And what's the length of the programme? Because looking at it, there's quite a bit of work to do.
There is a lot of work to do, yes. Thankfully, I've got a very good team behind me. I would like to say that by May time next year, I should have said this before, there was meant to be the 80th celebration of Operation Dynamo. So there was meant to be a flotilla of boats go from Southampton to Dunkirk in May this year. But because of COVID, that's been delayed for 1 year now. So the plan would be to have this in the state that I would like it to be in by May next year for when it can then return to Dunkirk.
And will that be with all flags and whistles and flags flying, or will it be a sort of low-key affair?
Oh, no, it won't be low-key. If it's going out, it's going out all hell's blazing.
So the plans for that, can people see that? Can they see the ships depart? I mean, it's early stages, obviously, but will there be public viewing opportunities?
Yes, there will be public viewing, and there will be spaces available on the passage to Dunkirk if people wanted to come.
The accommodation, there's not that much accommodation, is there?
No, there's not that much accommodation, but we just have to all be a little bit friendly.
Finally, can listeners who saw her in a sorry state in Shoreham and then when she sailed out to come to Southampton in resplendent new paint and with new boiler and a refurbished engine, can you guarantee that she'll be here for many years to come?
I will make it my mission to. If not, I'll die trying.
Chris, that's lovely. Thank you very much, and good luck.
Take care. Thank you very much.
We were hearing from the new owner of the historic Dunkirk little ship that was restored thanks to a lottery grant in Southwark Canal a few years ago. But now, back to Chris Seymour once again.
Well, I'm talking to Graham Shepherd here in Rottingdean in our makeshift studio about the Scarecrow competition, which is being held in Rottingdean this month of August. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Chris. Good morning. Good morning. Nice to see you again.
So, tell us about the Scarecrow competition. What's it all about?
Well, it started because David Hunt, who lives in Saltdean but is very heavily involved in the village, he was chatting to me on the phone. Of course, the Rottingdean Village Fair sadly didn't happen this year, and he just said in passing, how about a Scarecrow competition? Well, when he said it to Steph and I initially, I thought, well, no, I'm not quite sure about that. But then we thought it through, because the fact people have scarecrows in their own front gardens or shop windows, of course, social distancing wouldn't be a problem and people wandering around. So we thought we'd give it a go, and it took off like that, really.
How many people have entered?
Well, we started off with 10 and then we pushed along a bit. And now in the end, we had about 35, which for an inaugural event was absolutely excellent and really surprising, actually. And it's been very, very successful.
And these are all local Rottingdean residents?
Yes, it's just in Rottingdean, and it stretches from the north of Rottingdean through to central Rottingdean and also up into Rottingdean Heights. So it's rather nice because people can walk round and enjoy meeting other people. And what's been the big benefit is people being able to chat to each other and to go to places in Rottingdean perhaps they haven't been to before. So it's been really quite an eye-opener in a sense, really.
And it's for the benefit of the Rottingdean residents as well?
Yes, it's just for people to enjoy. And then we did a judging of it. And Linda Hyde, I don't even know if you know Linda Hyde, she was a former mayor and councillor and an alderman. I asked her to be the judge. So I walked round with her on the first morning. And we started at 10 and finished at 4 because we knocked on every door and spoke to the people who'd entered. And we had a good chat. It was a real privilege, actually. And then we gave prizes it was just awards, really, for first to fourth. And then everybody got a recognition. So we had the recognition for the cutest scarecrow, the wisest scarecrow, the most athletic scarecrow, the most literate scarecrow. And everybody was really delighted with it.
Do you plan to do this next year again?
Yes, I think so. I think it's one of those things. I mean, even if the village fair went ahead, I think it'd be nice to have in tandem with the village fair, because we were surprised really by the mix of scarecrows that we got. They weren't just the traditional sort. We had mermaids, we had Jacob Rees-Mogg lying across a bench, which was excellent. We had Rudyard Kipling, and up at Tudor Close we had the seven Cluedo characters, because Tudor Close, that's where it was based on up there. We had two scarecrows getting married on either side of a door. We had a little child scarecrow up in Neville Road, which is absolutely gorgeous. Of course, we had Boris Johnson as a scarecrow, and he got the prize for the most anxious scarecrow. We were trying to think something appropriate, and that's what we came up with. And then an amazing one, which was up the stables up in Bayshill Road, and it was a scarecrow up in a tree. It was someone who'd been riding a horse and been catapulted up into the tree, and so it was sort of a reincarnation of that. And anyway, that's a real good mix.
And do you have a favourite?
Oh, I don't... I thought the best one, and the one that got first prize, was in Coppers, and it's an absolute masterpiece. It's quite beautiful, really. But I did like the ones also in Tudor Close, the seven ones. But I think also the child was the cutest one up in Neville Road, was particularly good. And there was a mermaid, a fantastic mermaid, which is in Meadow Close and lying across somebody's garden, which is absolutely, absolutely delightful. But they're all fantastic. And the imagination from people is good. And people have really, really enjoyed it. And it really was a great success.
Yes, I was going to ask you, what's been from the local residents, what's been their opinion of it?
Well, really amazing, because we've got one in our house, actually, outside our front door. And people come along, we've been chatting to them. And people have really enjoyed just wandering around, really. It's an excuse, really, to be a bit nosy, to wander around other streets you don't normally go to, really. I think people tend to think Rottingdean is just the high street, because it extends up into the Heights and further north as well, and people have really found it a pleasure. I think it also has diverted away from the C word, and it's nice something else to talk about, really, and to sort of chat about. And we're going to publish the results in the next edition of the Rottingdean Village News, because we had the trail in the Rottingdean Village News, so people could follow either from bottom to top or top to bottom. And then we'll put photographs of each one in the October edition of the Village News.
Fine. Well, we look forward to the competition next year as well, then.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Chris.
We're hearing once again from Chris Seymour, who was talking there to Graham Shepherd about the Rottingdean scarecrows. For our final item in today's programme, we're joined on a fairly poor telephone line by the lady behind the Save the Madeira Arches campaign, Jax Atkins. Good morning, Jax, and welcome once again to At Home This Morning. And perhaps I could start by asking you if you're aware of what's happened to Madeira Drive over the past few months since lockdown.
Yes, I'm very much involved with it at the moment. There was a petition got up by local people and presented to council to ask to reopen Madeira Drive, signed by over 10,000 people, but went to full council, and they've just deferred it until the end of September. Quite annoying. They didn't even discuss it. And with this closing Madeira Drive down, you know, it's ridiculous on all levels, really. One, they've used COVID-19 as an excuse to shut it down. That's what it is, an excuse. It's far big enough for people to walk along and to run along, to cycle along, and for cars to park.
They're losing all the revenue, of course, aren't they?
Over 1.2 million a year. I've suggested as well that they use that revenue. They obviously don't need it. Before, their excuse has always been they need it to pay for the older people's bus passes and to pay for one of the buses' routes, number 21 or 22. Well, they obviously don't need it for Madeira Terraces, so that could go directly onto the arches every year, couldn't it? And looking at the directives, the laws or something, you can actually spend the parking revenue down there on the environment or road or a place next to the road you're getting the money from, which is Madeira Terraces.
And what's happening with the terraces currently?
Nothing. We've got an advisory panel. We meet every month with members of the council. Nothing's happening. It's just a load of talk, quite honestly, at the moment. And, you know, they're discussing big ideas. You know, put electricity in, services, water, blah, 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 so you can put businesses in there. But really, we've all gone back to the idea on the Save Madeira Terraces group and other people to restore them as they were, you know, just to walk along, stroll underneath, sit there and read, get the sun. And if they got that revenue from the parking, that would more than pay for it, the upkeep of them, wouldn't it? Easily. We've got people who clean there. I've got someone who will then provide lighting. Paint company will donate paint to me.
What's happened to the money that you have raised and the council have raised?
Well, all the crowdfunding money, of which we gave $17,000 to, the council have still got it in an account somewhere, apparently. It hasn't been touched. And that's there specifically to restore 3 to 5 arches, which should have been done by now. What? And they haven't been. They were meant to be the test, you know, see how much it would cost, how complicated it was, blah, blah. But that hasn't happened in nearly 3 years.
What can the residents do?
Nothing. The residents complain, the residents ask questions, and you just get ignored. It gets put, you know, on the back burner. You know, it's ridiculous. And at this time and now, you know, after COVID, which has been disastrous for people's revenues, the council, everyone, you'd think that they would jump at the chance just to get them back to as they were, get them used. And they're an attraction to Brighton. No one else has got them. They're stunning architecturally, I think. No one else has got them. They're our window. We have all the events down there. We could extend that. We could have like Sunday markets under the arches when they're done and pop up stalls and things. It would be really nice. Then you wouldn't need to provide all these flash extras that cost millions of pounds.
Do you think those events will continue? Do you think the veteran car run will happen?
The council said it will happen this year. We'll wait and see. I mean, they should happen. They bring money and they bring people in, you know, and they make the place vibrant and alive, which is what it needs. And, you know, the businesses there are really suffering. All the businesses that have been there for years and years, J.J. Braden, the Tarot Reader and the Madeira Cafe, all their businesses are really suffering because no one's going there now. You can't even get motorbikes down there, you know, because they do rely on people coming in cars. And in the winter as well, if you've got no cars going up and down there, who's going to be there? Nothing, are there? There's going to be nothing. No one seems to want to do that anything. It's a general apathy. No, we have this advisory panel, and there's a council, the project manager, and a group of us from the residents group, representing them, from the businesses, from entertainment, from the Green Wall. You discuss it, but nothing happens. Nothing whatsoever happens.
It has been suggested that it's a deliberate ploy to let the arches fall down.
Yes, I don't know. I can't say it yes for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me. The council, there are some people in the council, or there were, who are very, very concerned. I mean, Warren Morgan, when he was there, he started the crowdfunding up, and he was excellent. He really wanted to get it, you know, off the ground and going. No one seems to be particularly interested now. It's a secondary thing. It doesn't matter. It's like the whole face of Brighton. Brighton's looking terrible at the moment. Not cared for, abandoned. And there's always these excuses of why they haven't got the money. But they can find the money for certain vanity projects. I think they need to get their priority right and make Brighton look good so people will come here, spend their money, because that's what we need.
Indeed we do. And let's hope that something does happen before it's all too late and demolition is the only alternative. I was talking there to Jax Atkins from the Save the Madeira Drive Arches campaign. And that just about brings us to the end of this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme that's brought to you by Brighton's only truly local radio station, Radio Reverb, broadcasting on 97.2 FM, on digital radio, and online at Radio Reverb. So until next time we meet over the airwaves in about 4 weeks' time, it's goodbye from me. However, don't forget that our executive producer, technical operator Bar None, and my co-presenter Richard Davis will be here with his next show in just 2 weeks. But there's just time for me to say I've just heard that our local branch of Age UK are looking for volunteers to make some face masks, so that the charity can distribute them to the elderly in our area. If you're able to help, please contact Age UK, Brighton, Hove and West Sussex on 01903 731 800. That's 01903 731 800. You've been listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb. But just before I do sign off, may I remind you that you can listen again to a selection of some of the more recent editions of At Home This Morning by just visiting our website, which you can find by just putting Grey Matters Productions, CIC, into your internet browser and then selecting the Listen Again tabs. And so, until we next meet over the airwaves in about 4 weeks' time, this is Chris English signing off as usual with Please Keep Safe. Bye for now.